So, continue the book of Amos. And so we've covered the nations, but last week we started, I guess the last couple of weeks, we took care of Judah a couple of weeks ago and then finished that up last week. And finally turned our attention to Israel, the northern kingdom. And that is really what this great book is all about, a condemnation upon them. It doesn't mean that Judah is perfect, because they were far from it. In the end, they may have become worse even than Israel, and were carried away under captivity themselves. But at this point, you might remember from your own biblical history that the Israelites had no kings that were good. They were all wicked. They all did evil in the sight of God, while there were a handful of good kings that preserved the southern nation, which, even as I say that, it's interesting that it works like that, that nations that do what's right and that are righteous please God. And with Judah, it allowed them to last several more years than hundreds of years longer than the northern kingdom, all because they had a few good kings that would cleanse the kingdom and get rid of the idols and start serving God. The problem is it didn't last. In the end, they had to pay the price as well. But last week we started looking at the oracles of Israel. And so we were working on Israel's sinful acts. And if you weren't here, there are four things that Amos, and maybe I should say God through Amos, points out, and that is that they were going to be punished. Judgment was going to come upon them for the sin of injustice. And we'll not get into all of these things, only just read them in the text. That's in Amos 2, and at verse 6 is where he turns his attention to them. In the middle of verse 6, it says, because they sell the righteous for silver and the needy for a pair of shoes, those who trample the head of the poor into the dust of the earth and turn aside the way of the afflicted. So basically, we kind of summarized that last week by saying they simply were treating the poor like dirt, is basically what that last phrase there means. But you can see that just how terribly they treated the poor. And God, now remember what we saw in the very beginning with Amos, that Amos was particularly irritated by that because of the kind of person he was. He was a righteous man, the way that they mistreated brethren really irked him. And you can tell it in the way that he prophesied. He was a very hard prophet. He spoke the truth, got right down to it. Didn't pull any punches, so to speak, at all, because of just the way that they were behaving. So they had the sin of injustice. We saw their immorality had overtaken them. And that is described briefly again. It says in the rest of verse 7, a man and his father go in to the same girl so that my holy name is profaned. Probably referring to the prostitutes the shrine that they would have for prostitutes and, you know, that sort of thing. And so it was also a form of idolatry, all of that. I pointed out last week that some commentators said that it's possible that the girl under consideration here would be a slave girl that maybe the father purchased for the son, so on. And that would even be a more horrific kind of situation. But as you think about these sins, just remember, we're dealing with the people of God. Not the nations anymore, but the people of God. So he condemns them for this. Their heartlessness. In verse 8, it says, and they lay themselves down beside every altar on garments taken in a pledge. And so... that is referring to the fact that when somebody owed something, They may have to give up their garment to the person that they owe money to, or whatever the situation was. But that person, according to the law of Moses, that person had to give the garment back by the end of the day, by nighttime, because it served as an outer garment during the day and a blanket at night. So it was just consideration and kindness to do that. They had to give it up again the next day until they paid their debt. But at night, they would have a blanket to keep them warm the cool nights. And so what they were doing in Israel, they got to the point where they were taking the pledge, they wouldn't give it back. And then, as I said last week, I think this is, in fact, about where we closed. But they lay themselves down beside every altar. You know, we can't be sure what that is referring to. But you just read that and you know it's not good. I mean, at the very least, they were doing something religiously that was out of taste. You know, laying on a garment, you know that it belongs to someone else who is now somewhere cold, because you decide to lay on their garment at night by an altar. Or it could be, again, many scholars believe that they were actually involved in sexual immorality, like there, before the altar or beside the altar. So just, again, a terrible situation. Sinfulness that Israel has fallen into. And then one more thing that we didn't get to last week is their hypocrisy. And we see that at the end of verse 8, where it says, "And in the house of their God, they drank the wine of those who have been fined." And so they would, in a dishonest way, they would fine individuals that who were innocent, and they would take the money they got and buy wine and drink it in the house of their God. And so it showed hypocrisy. Like, you remember with Israel, the real place to worship was in Jerusalem. They couldn't do that because, again, of the dividing of the kingdom. So they had places of worship in Dan and Bethel. And so that when it talks about the house of their God, that's probably what's under consideration. So they would pretend. They would go to one of these places of worship. Like, it wasn't going to help them any, because they weren't worshiping right in the first place. It'd be like denominational folks who worship, they think, but it's not helping them because it's not according to God's will. Well, the northern kingdom never could please God. Throughout their history, as long as they were going to Bethel, to an altar there to worship God, instead of to the temple in Jerusalem or the tabernacle in Jerusalem, they weren't going to please God. But the point here is, they thought in their own mind, they were so deceived that they could worship in those places, and they were doing it hypocritically. Because even in those fake places of worship, they were pretending to worship God at drinking the wine that they got dishonestly from people that they had cheated. And so they were hypocrites. That's the bottom line with Israel. And so you have then these four sins. And as we said, even when we were dealing with nations, they remember just one sin would be identified. This is not an exhaustive list of the sins of Israel. But, I mean, he could go on and on and on. At some point, you got to stop here. But these are four things that you could look at and say, man, Israel was in a mess. You know why judgment is coming. Because this is just the way that they were behaving and acting. So they were unfaithful to God, breaking the covenant, and they were immoral, and they were unrighteous, and they treated people badly. Just like the nations did. They treated people in a poor way. And so that's why they are going to be judged. Now, what Amos does in verses 9 through 11 then is he holds up God as a contrast and how God was treating them. And it would really make their sins just look so much worse. Like you can't imagine after God has done so much for you that you would still be unfaithful and treat him in the way that you are. And like these sins would be wrong no matter what. But when you hold them up against a righteous, loving, merciful God, it makes it even worse. Like if somebody, this might be a poor illustration of it, but let's say you're on the job and you were stealing from your boss. Like that would always be wrong, wouldn't it? No matter what. But let's just say it was a boss who was cruel and mistreating all of his employees and that sort of thing and cheating them and whatnot. Well, just from a human standpoint, we know as Christians that'd always be wrong to steal from your boss. But if you saw someone doing that and that was the case, you know, I say, well, he shouldn't do that, but you know, this guy is getting what he deserved. But what if the boss was a very kind employer that would treat all of his employees well and give them promotions and help them and be merciful to them, and then you find out that there was an employee that was stealing from him or betraying him in some way, that would magnify it, wouldn't it? That you would think, that how can you treat that man like that after all that he's done for you? And that's kind of the picture. That's why that Amos is doing what he's doing here. Like the sins of Israel are bad no matter what. No matter what the nature of God is. But then when you stop and think of all that God has done for them, it just accentuates the situation. And that's what I say Amos, but this is what God is doing through Amos. He's letting them know. So here's verses 9 through 11, and it says, yet it was I who destroyed the Amorite before them, whose height was like the height of the cedars, and who was as strong as the oaks. I destroyed his fruit from above and his roots from beneath. Also, it was I who brought you up out of the land of Egypt and led you for 40 years in the wilderness to possess the land of the Amorite. And I raised up some of your sons for your prophets and some of your young men for Nazarites. Is it not indeed so, O people of Israel, declares the Lord. So let's just look at these things that he brings up. The first one, God destroyed the Amorite. Now, the Amorite here, it's used, even by Amos in this immediate context, it's used both broadly and then more narrowly with regard to the Amorites amongst the Canaanites. But it's kind of confusing in the Old Testament when you're reading about the Canaanites. And I use that term very broadly. Like sometimes in the Bible, the Canaanites were all of the inhabitants of Canaan. Sometimes the Amorites were all of the inhabitants of Canaan. And sometimes the Amorites refer to just a particular tribe amongst all of particular people, amongst all of the people there. A particular nation within all of the people who occupied Canaan. And with regard to the Amorite, the Amorites were particularly fierce and strong and powerful people. So Amos is kind of using that in both senses. When he refers to destroying the Amorites, of course, God would destroy the people of Canaan, drive them out himself. But the Amorite itself, that people, like, when's the last time you've shook hands with an Amorite? Got any Amorite friends? You work with any Amorites? No, they don't exist. God destroyed them. And so, and again, when you think about this and who they were, I just said that they were a powerful people. You remember some of that, don't you? Like in Numbers chapter 22, this has to do more broadly with the Canaanites as a whole. But in Numbers chapter, when I said chapter 13 is what I want. I may have said 32, but the Numbers chapter 13, and you're familiar with this, I'm sure. But this is the time when they were going to occupy, going into to occupy the land. That's what they were supposed to do. But they didn't do it because of a lack of faith. And this is why in Numbers 13 at verse 32. And so they brought to the people of Israel a bad report of the land that they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone to spy it out is a land that devours its inhabitants. And all the people that we saw in it are of great height. And there we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, who come from the Nephilim. And we seemed ourselves like grasshoppers, and so we seemed to them." So you remember that as they were wanting to, you know, they should have just gone into the land and took it. Because God told them, "I'm giving it to you." All they had to do was do it, but they had a lack of faith. And their faith left them when they saw the people over there. And they were giants is what they were. In Deuteronomy chapter 1, notice in this place, it says about the same thing, but it's a little broader. In verse 28, Deuteronomy 1, and at verse 28, it says, "We are going up. Our brothers have made our hearts melt, saying, 'The people are greater and taller than we. The cities are great and fortified up to heaven.'" Like, that's the kind of language that would be used when they were really trying to emphasize something that was so great, like the Tower of Babel reaching the heavens. That didn't literally mean it went up to God, but yeah, they're just huge. In Canaan, the cities were great cities, something the Israelites had never seen before. And just their heights, the height of the buildings, and then the people themselves were just a powerful people. Now, when you go forward to the time that they went into the land, what changed about that? Like, you fast forward from this in Numbers and you think about when they actually went in and occupied the land. You remember over in Joshua, just turn over there. And this will give us again some insight to how God is feeling about this. In Joshua, I believe chapter 10 and at verse 31 beginning, we'll not read all of this. But in Joshua 10 and at verse 31, it says, "Then Joshua and all Israel with him passed on from Libna to Lachish and laid siege to it and fought against it." So now we have the conquest. This is the conquest going on. And again, just think, this is 40 years later now than what we read in Numbers chapter 13. What's changed so far as the inhabitants of the land? Have the giants decided to go live somewhere else? No. Their cities are still great. And the sons of Anak are still there. And they're still more powerful than the Israelites. But listen to this. It says at verse 32, "And the Lord gave Lachish into the hand of Israel, and he captured it on the second day and struck it with the edge of the sword and every person in it as he had done to Libna." Now, we could read the next several verses and it would all read the same thing. But that key there at verse 32, "And the Lord gave Lachish into the hand of Israel." Don't you know, Israel had no chance of occupying the land of Canaan without God's help. Because they were grasshoppers in the sight of the giants in the land. And there were all kinds of things that the Canaanites, they knew the lay of the land. They were experienced warriors. The Israelites weren't any of that. But you keep reading this, and they went and they conquered city after city. These great men fell. Their great cities were destroyed, and Israel took over. Well, how in the world did they do that? It's tells us right here, "The Lord gave Lachish into their hand. Down later on at verse 42, it says, and Joshua captured all these kings and their land as at one time because the Lord God of Israel fought for Israel. That's how they pulled it off. And in Amos, God is reminding them of that. It was I, he says. That's emphatic. God's upset. And he's telling them, you're behaving like this. All this injustice, all this immorality, all this hard-heartedness and hypocrisy, all of this, and it was I who destroyed the Amorite before them, whose height, he says, and again, we kind of covered all that, whose height was like the height of the cedars. Two similes that he emphasizes there, just to show how powerful they are. Their height is like the height of cedars, and who was as strong as the oaks. No, you didn't have a chance going up against them. But God said, I gave them to you. That's what he did. And then I brought you up out of the land of Egypt. The second thing he emphasizes. That's no small thing. Some scholars are troubled because of the chronology of that. Which came first? Well, you know, he's kind of going backwards there. But a lot of that is just for effect. Like, he almost like you're saving the best for last. Because when you think of what God did for Israel, bringing them out of Egypt, and, you know, he destroyed Pharaoh. He showed himself easily to be far more powerful than the Egyptian gods, led them through the Red Sea. All of that was showed the great power of God, but it also showed his love and his kindness for the people of Israel. He brought them out of Egypt. That's all that generation knew. They were there. How long were they in Egypt? 430 years. That's all the generation knew, slavery. And God reached out and delivered them from that terrible situation. There's a passage in Exodus where God says to them, or Moses says to the people, remember this day. This is, you know from where it's located, Exodus 13. This is, they're leaving Egypt. And on that day, on that time, he said, remember this day in which you came out of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Like, that was so significant. That was the time for all of them to remember. You can imagine the joy that they had when they marched out of Egypt and they were free. That just a wonderful thing. But how did it all happen? He said, it's all by a strong hand. The Lord brought you out of this place by a strong hand. It was God. Like, is that something you should just forget? Of course not. One of the things that we learn in all of this, and there's passages that we'll look at, but God, you know, one of the things you say, what makes God mad? Well, idolatry, that makes God mad. Yes, it does. Well, drunkenness, that makes God mad. Well, sexual immorality, that's terrible. It destroys nations. That makes God mad. Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know what is right there at the top of the list? Not being thankful. That makes God mad. And we see that in several places, both in the Old and the New Testament. People aren't thankful for what they have, for what God has given them. And this is where some of the practical applications could come in. Because now we're the people of God. It's very easy for us to find ourselves not being thankful for what we have. And you better know, when that God's not pleased when that happens. And so he Moses is reminding you, remember this day. And then he goes on to say that he led them for 40 years in the wilderness. Now, actually, that was punishment. But at the same time, I mean, they had to survive. And what did God do during those 40 years? Right. Fed them, gave them provision for that. He led them and guided them and kept them safe. Every day, every night, for 40 years, God's making provision for them. And so God just pointed this out. I've done all of this, and this is the way you all are paying me back. This is how you're living. You've forsaken me. You're serving other gods in most horrific, sinful ways. You've turned over to false gods. And he goes on. God had raised up spiritual leaders to guide them. And he said he gave them the prophets and the Nazarites. And so what did the prophets do? Right. They revealed God's will. They spoke by inspiration. And so they had revelation from God to help them. And so, I mean, we should never take that for granted. We've talked about that many times before. We have the Bible today. It is a wonderful thing, a great advantage in life to have the Word of God. Like, you have a great advantage. Those of you who not only are Christians, but you read and study your Bibles and you live by it, you know God's will, you have a great advantage over everyone else in the whole world that doesn't have that. Nothing to brag about. We are what we are by the grace of God, and that's the point of the whole thing. Be thankful of what you have. Well, the Israelites had that. Remember those nations we were dealing with? God never talked about the covenant, any of that. They didn't have any revelation. I remember Romans chapter 3, Paul anticipated the question, well, all right, if Gentiles, you know, they're saved too, what advantage do we have? Paul said, much every way, because you have the oracles of God. That's not something to take lightly. They had the prophets and they had the Nazarites. Who were the Nazarites? Huh? No, he wasn't a Nazarite. Who? Samson was. He was a Nazarite. That's right. And that's good. I wasn't really asking for a specific. Really. There are two men we know were Nazarites, Samson and who else? Samuel was one. They say John the Baptist, but it doesn't say, we're not told that he was a Nazarite. Though, what did two things the Nazarites had to do? One was what? Not cut their hair. We all remember that. So you got Samson, and what's going on with my internet here? I lost my picture. Somebody help me. So you got Samson and he, of course, the hair thing. So you know that. What was the other thing? They couldn't drink wine or strong drink. And so I don't remember reading anything about John the Baptist not being able to cut his hair, whatever. But they always list those three as the Nazarites. But the point of really what I was getting at is this, the Nazarite, because those are the ones we know. All right, so let me put it like this. There were two different kinds of Nazarites. Usually the people would take a vow and they would observe those things, like not cutting their hair, not drinking strong drink for a certain amount of time, might be 100 days or whatever. And, you know, that's what the people of Israel had. They had these people who were consecrated, devoted to God, and they demonstrated that by taking the Nazarite vow. Then you had a few, the ones that we just mentioned, who were lifelong Nazarites, they became Nazarite of no choice of their own. They were born, and it was from their parents, they were Nazarites. So, but it was in the more general sense, the Israelites always had Nazarites. There are always among them Nazarites, people devoted to God, who would serve as a good example of what it means to be committed to God, willing to sacrifice and live according to strict rules because you're showing God respect and honor. They had that example. Let me ask you this. Are examples important? Yeah, they're important. Wonderful. It's great here. We have some great examples here at Brown Street. Good examples of husbands, of wives. The list goes on. Brethren, you know, that's good. That's a good thing. Paul told us in one place to follow those examples. So that's good. Well, Israelite had them. So they had revelation. So they had good spiritual leadership in the form of the prophets. Not so much the kings, but in the form of the prophets, bold men like Elijah and Elisha and Hosea, and the list goes on of prophets who lived at that particular time. And so they had them, and then they had among them these Nazarites who were just a great example of what it means to be committed and devoted to God. So you had no excuse like, I don't know what that looks like. Yes, you do. You have all of these Nazarites around to show you. And God is using that. God is telling them, look, that didn't happen on accident. God gave them to the Israelites to keep them strong, to guide them. And yet they ignored it all. What it reminds me of is for us today, you remember in 2 Peter 1 at verse 3, and his divine power has granted us all things that pertain to life and godliness through the knowledge of him who called us to his own glory and excellence. Well, that's what God did for the Israelites. He gave them everything they needed to be the kind of people he wanted. And they failed miserably. And God has given us. There's no excuse for us. If we're not what God wants us to be, he has given us everything we need that pertains to life and godliness. It's up to us to take advantage of it. But the Jews, of course, did not. And so he's condemning them. And then we find in verse 12 the ultimate ingratitude. And so quickly, the second bell's about to ring. But at verse 12 it says, But you made the Nazarites to drink wine. Think of how terrible this is. God gave them the Nazarites to show them what consecration looks like, what devotion, commitment looks like. And they forced these Nazarites at times to drink wine. Like, how did that happen? Can you imagine them taking these servants of God who were just living lives consecrated to God and probably making fun of them and forcing them, oh yeah, you're going to drink wine, and making them drink wine? And you think, oh, that's going unnoticed by God. No, it's not. But that's what they did. And they then, well, I got Romans 1 up here. We don't have to read all of this, but we're kind of running out of time anyway. But look at Romans 1. Let's just go ahead and turn over there. Because here, there is a principle here as well. In Romans chapter 1. So it's one thing that the Jews were wicked and doing all this evil stuff, but then to take people who were devoted and committed to God and cause them, try to force them into sinning and being unfaithful, that's like rock bottom. And in Romans chapter 1, you could start at verse 18, and I won't read all of this except for one verse in here. At verse... let's see if I can find the, I might have to read it just to find it. Verse 19, for what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made, so that they are without excuse. For although they knew God, neither did they honor him. Now here it is. Neither did they did not honor him as God or what? Give thanks to him. What did I say earlier? What makes God mad? Ingratitude. Not being grateful. It's amazing that God points this out here. Because he goes on to talk about sins you think are far worse than not being thankful. Not in the eyes of God. It's all bad. It's all sinful. And then you get to the final verse and it says, though they knew God's righteous decree, that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but give approval to those who practice them. That kind of sounds like the Jews in the days of Amos. Except for they were even worse. They not only sinned. Paul is saying these Gentiles, they loved to sin. And they approved of other people sinning. The Jew, now he's talking about nations here in Romans 1, the Gentiles. But the Jews in Amos' day, they loved to sin. And they made the Nazarites drink wine. That's amazing. That is low. From a spiritual standpoint. And they commanded the prophets saying, you shall not prophesy. And so the two things that God gave them to help them and guide them and keep them on the right track. This was their response. To the Nazarites, they made them break their vows. To the prophets, they commanded, stop prophesying. And we have example of that. Amos is an example of that. We don't have time now, but we'll read it next week. Where Amos, the king, and they did their best to shut him up. And so he's speaking firsthand. He knows firsthand what he's talking about. And we have there are other passages where prophets were commanded not to speak. Because the one thing that the kings wanted, that's why they had all these false prophets. So the prophets would do what? Tell them what they wanted to hear. That's exactly right. And so when a true prophet came along and told them something, no, God doesn't want you to do that, they'd usually be thrown in jail or worse. So that was their history. Commanded the prophet saying, you shall not prophesy. Now you hold that up. You just think about all of that. Hold that up against a righteous God who's been nothing but kind and loving to them. You start getting the picture, Israel was not good. So judgment is coming. So we'll pick up there next week.